Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. On today's episode of PD Stories, I interview Sergeant Michael Lartamita from the Las Vegas Police Department. He discusses the wild things that stay in Vegas long after people leave and the amazing circumstances behind his 5 life-saving service awards. Mike, what inspired you to become a police officer?
Well, I think the biggest part was my family. My father was a retired police officer from Ohio. He did almost 20 years in a little small town outside Cleveland called North Randall Police Department. His brother, my uncle, was also an officer back in Ohio. And then once we moved out to Vegas, when I was just a youngin, my older brother joined the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. He did almost 22 years here, retired as a detective. And then I actually coincidentally married an officer. So it was pretty much in my blood. It was something I had always thought of. It was always in the back of my mind through high school. Kind of didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I was getting ready to go off to college. I had some football offers to go play out of state. But one day, my brother offered me the opportunity to go on a ride along with him. He was working our downtown area command graveyard shift. And after that ride along, I knew 100% that that's exactly what I wanted to do. So that solidified it in my mind that this was my calling and this is what I was meant to do. It was just so much fun. And I saw the excitement and everything that Vegas had to offer for an officer. And I knew I had to do it.
What year did you join the force?
So I started in 1996. At that time, I worked as a civilian at our Clark County Detention Center for the police department. I worked in the jail for a little over a year. And then the police officer exam came up and I tested and I made it. And 2 months after my 21st birthday in July of 97, I started the academy.
Tell me about your rookie year.
My rookie year, pretty exciting. The one good thing about it was I had a leg up. I had joined the department's Explorer program back when I was 18, 19 years old. So I was a little familiar with the inner workings of the department and their procedures, and I had gotten to go on ride along. So I was familiar with what was going on. So the academy itself was a breeze. I had a lot of the knowledge going into the academy. But of course, you learn how to be a police officer out on the street. You know, you get that base foundation while you're in the academy and laws and criminal procedures and things like that. But you actually learn how to be a cop on the street. So my first year out there as a rookie was great. We have a field training program here that at the time it was 18 weeks and it was split up over 3 week increments where you switched off with different field training officers. So I was very lucky where each of my different field training officers gave me a little different type of experience. I had one who was in the gang unit. I had one who was a SWAT officer. I had one who did a lot of administrative stuff, one who was a good report writer. So it kind of gave me a little tool to stick in my belt for every different training officer that I had that I think really helped me become a good police officer. So my first year was great. Had a blast. You kind of looked at it as when my days off came, it wasn't, oh, great, my days off are here. It was like, oh, man, I don't get to go to work for 3 more days. So it was just that exciting to get back to work. It was great. It was a good time.
You were uniform patrol starting out?
I was, correct.
You remember your first traffic stop?
I sure do. My first traffic stop, I worked over in the, we call it the Nora area, which is kind of east of the Strip. And I remember being pretty nervous, and it was just a simple violation of running a stoplight. But I knew the pressure of being watched over by my field training officer. I think I was more worried about being watched over by my training officer than I was actually dealing with the traffic violator. But everything went smooth, and I got to write my first ticket, and it was for the stop sign violation, and kind of put that little notch in my belt like, okay, I'm here and it's real.
Now, did you do undercover work at some point in your career?
I'd done plainclothes stuff. Never did anything undercover as far as narcotics buys. We have different specialized units within the department. At one point, I was on our investigative unit when I was assigned to the resident section down in Laughlin, where we basically acted as detectives. But we also did some additional stuff where surveillance and things like that. And we were on a motorcycle theft task force during the Laughlin River run, things like that. And at one point during both when I was at our Northeast Area Command and our Downtown Area Command, I assisted with our, we call it our PSU, our Problem Solving Unit, which they're a plainclothes unit. During that, we did a lot of surveillance and narcotics purchases with confidential informants. And then as a result of that, we would do search warrants and things like that. But never did any undercover stuff as far as going out and doing narcotics buys and things like that myself. It was more of the plainclothes surveillance aspect of it.
If I recall correctly, even though Laughlin is a ways away from Las Vegas, they're in the same county, right?
Correct. Yeah. Clark County is about a little over 8,000 square miles, and the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, we're basically like the county sheriffs. Back in 73, the City of Las Vegas Police Department and the Clark County Sheriff's Department merged, and we became the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. So we're actually responsible for all areas of Clark County. So when I was assigned to the resident section down in Laughlin, we would cover everything from basically the turnoff to Laughlin from Boulder City all the way down to Laughlin itself. So we covered the smaller towns like Searchlight, Nevada, Nelson, Nevada, Laughlin itself, and then extended all the way towards Nipton where the California line is. So it was quite a big area, and we had very limited resources down there as far as officers. So because we were so such a small unit, and because we were so far away from the resources in Vegas, working in that aspect, we had to have a ton of additional training to work in that area.
Do you remember the first time you ever encountered a fatality in the line of duty?
I remember the first time I actually saw a person die right there in front of me. We had the call of a shots fired. This is when I was just out of field training, I believe, and I was working the Northeast Area Command. And we had a call of shots fired. We responded to the area, and I was the first one there. And as I pulled up, I'm making my approach, and it was really, really dark area. There wasn't a whole lot of street lights. And this guy popped out of his house really quick, and he had something in his hand. And I couldn't tell what it was, so I'm screaming at him because I thought he had a gun. And he's yelling at me that he's around the corner, and I'm telling him, drop it. And it was just a phone in his hand. So that had already amped me up. And as I run on foot around the corner, once I know for sure that this guy had a phone in his hand, I get around the corner, and there's this guy right in the middle of the street. And as I round the corner of the street, he's on his knees and he goes down to his stomach. So he's laying basically almost in a prone position. And I rolled him over, and his eyes were open, and he had a huge hole in his chest. And he looked up at me, and I still remember it. I mean, like it was yesterday. I heard just a breath. Mm-hmm. And that was it. He was gone. It was the last breath he took. I can't describe it any further. I mean, it was just, it'll always stick with me.
It's what they call the death gasp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
What were some of the more bizarre things you encountered in Vegas? I mean, Vegas is a very, very interesting city. I did a lot of cases with America's Most Wanted out there over a 19-year span from 93 to like 2012. And so I worked on some really bizarre homicide cases out there. And I know you had to have encountered a lot of really strange things too.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think there's just been so many of them that they kind of blend together. You know, I recall most recently out at the airport, you know, you don't think of the airport being really a hubbub of a lot of criminal activity, but, you know, we have our share of of our intoxicated people both coming and going from mm-hmm. Vegas, you know, yeah. and partied a little bit too hard. And one night we get a call at one of the gates where a custodian had reported that a gentleman was touching himself inappropriately. And, you know, this is later on in the evening, 1-2 o'clock in the morning, and there's not entirely a lot of people at the airport, but, you know, there's still flights coming in and out. So a couple officers dispatched themselves. They headed that way, and the airport has a lot of cameras. So our control center had turned on their cameras towards that area to see if we could pick him up, and they located him, and they said he was laying on the floor near basically the windows where you would look out towards the airplane, but they couldn't really tell what he was doing at first as the officers were going. So I dispatched myself also, started heading that way. And then the dispatchers advised that, he was in fact inappropriately touching himself and that he had his pants down. So now it's starting to get a little more weird because, again, we're in the middle of an airport. So the officers get there after a short time, and by this time he's fully clothed and he's standing up and completely denying everything. Said, you know, I wasn't doing anything, and he was actually pretty convincing too. So,
how old was this guy?
Late 30s, early 40s. Mm. And like I said, pretty convincing. Said, no, I wasn't touching myself. I wasn't doing anything. And so we did records check, make sure he wasn't any kind of sex offender from out of state or anything. And so I'm thinking to myself at first, well, you know, maybe it was a misunderstanding. Maybe he was putting his clothes on, and in doing so, he exposed himself, and, you know, someone got the wrong idea. So we had one of our officers go up to our control center and review the video. And as we're standing there, we started escorting him towards the non-secured side of the airport. And the officer calls down over the radio. And he says, he tells the officer that's escorting him. He goes, yep, we got enough for open and gross lewdness. Go ahead and hook him up. Mm-hmm. So they turn him around and they throw him in handcuffs. So I call up to the control center as they're escorting him away. And I ask the officer, hey, what was this guy doing? And the officer is like, Sarge, this guy was laying down and he was completely naked from the waist down. And he was touching himself with the right hand in the front and the left hand in the back. And oh, he was Lord. Just going at it both ways in the middle of the airport. So I chuckled briefly, but then I paused and I said, wait a second. I said, so he was touching both sides of himself, correct? And the officer's like, yes, sir. And I said, and you called over the radio and had your partner put his hands on him and handcuff him and didn't tell him to put his gloves on first. So he got razzed about that pretty good, where I told him, I said, next time we got some guys who feel like touching themselves inappropriately on both sides of their body, let's make sure we put some gloves on first before we go hands on. So, very bizarre and very odd. But, you know, that's Vegas. People think that they could just get away with everything or anything here. It's nuts.
You know, the most raucous flight I was ever on was on the way to Vegas. And there were these guys who were like some Texas. They got on in Texas, in Dallas. And they were oil field workers who were on the way to Vegas to party. And as soon as we got airborne and drinks started getting served, within an hour, they were all filthy drunk. And the stewardesses didn't even cut them off initially as Wow. they got worse. And they started throwing peanuts at one of the stewardesses who was a male, kind of a timid sort of guy. And they were like throwing peanuts at him and calling them all kinds of names, and I was sitting right in front of them, and I got so angry, as you know, this is a long flight, you know. And finally I turned around and I said, listen, if you say one more thing to that stewardess that's wrong out of your mouth, I'm gonna call some people in Vegas on the ground who are gangbangers, and we're gonna meet you at the airport. I swear to God, if you say one more thing to him, I'm gonna call my people, and when you get to Vegas, it's not gonna be a party. And they looked at me like, because they didn't know who I was, you know.
Right.
And they kind of calmed down after that, and they left him alone anyway. They still were loud, but they left him alone because he was too scared to even stand up for himself. And it just finally just got to me. But yeah, I mean, you guys see everything in Vegas when it comes to people behaving badly.
Absolutely. And when we go out of town, it doesn't matter where we go, but anytime we get on that flight to come home, that flight's a party. It doesn't matter if it's 5 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock at night. They're partying on that plane because everybody knows is when it comes to Vegas, it's time to party and time to have fun.
Now, you've received the Life-Saving Award 5 times?
Yeah, I've received 5 different ones.
What was the first one for?
The first one was early in my career, around 99 or 2000, when I was working downtown. Myself and a traffic officer, well, I myself and another officer had gotten a call of a possible suicidal subject. One of our traffic officers, our motor officers, also responded to assist. So we arrive at a local apartment complex, and when we get to the area, there's this guy. He's up on the second floor of the apartment complex on the ledge of the balcony, and there's this large industrial spool of cable. And he had taken some off. It was still connected to the spool, but he had completely tied it around his neck. And he was standing over the rail on the ledge, and just a pair of shorts on. And so we're trying to talk to him, trying to establish a rapport, you know, trying to get him down. He was having none of that. So I gradually made my way up to the second floor where I was talking to him. And again, he was pretty intent on killing himself. He didn't want to live anymore, and things were going wrong in his life, and he had been using drugs and stuff like that. So we're trying to calm him down. Officer Moore was the traffic officer. He was down on the ground, and Officer Smith, she was one of the other patrol officers who had arrived. She was trying to talk to him also. And as I'm trying to inch closer just to talk to him, you know, hopefully try to get this guy back over the ledge. And as he saw me getting closer and he saw Officer Moore kind of walking towards the ledge, I think he kind of figured what we were trying to do. And he actually jumped. And I was close enough at that point where when he jumped, I reached out and grabbed his arm. And by the miracle of God, I caught it. And I caught his arm. But now I'm holding this 150, 160-pound man over the ledge, while I'm dangling over the ledge also holding him. So I'm holding him with all his weight with one arm dangling over the ledge, because I know if I let him go that that rope or the cable is going to snap his neck. So I'm just holding him, trying to pull him back up just so there's no tension on his neck. And Officer Moore had come running up the stairs. And so now he's grabbing me, and we eventually pulled me and the subject back over the ledge. And prevented him from committing suicide.
Was he grateful?
No, he actually fought with us once we got him back over the ledge. He was pretty upset, and I think he was pretty high on drugs, and he fought with all three of us before we could get him in custody and take him off to the hospital.
Wow. What was the second life-saving award situation?
The second one I had, that was down when I was working in Laughlin. We had received a call of a male subject. His family, he called, said he was intent on committing suicide. And he called and said his goodbyes, said he was going to inhale some carbon monoxide fumes in the garage. So I had rolled code 3. I was down in our casino area. He lived up in the residential area, which is a few miles away. So I rolled up there. I was the first officer to arrive. And I could hear a vehicle running inside of the closed garage. So I tried opening the garage door, wasn't doing anything. The front door was locked, couldn't get in that way. So I went around the side and I found a side door to the garage, and I booted the door in. And as soon as I kicked that door in, I saw him sitting in his vehicle. It was a Jeep, and he had the radio blaring in the Jeep, and the whole garage was just completely filled with fumes. And I saw that he had barricaded the garage door where the vehicles go in and out, so no one could get in that way. So I ran over to him and tried to wake him up, but he was completely out of it. And I saw an empty bottle of vodka on the seat next to him. So I dragged him out of the Jeep, and he was complete dead weight at that point. So I'm trying to drag him out of the garage. He's on the opposite side, and I'm trying to hold my breath to not inhale these fumes, but that wasn't working. So I got pretty good ingestion of the carbon monoxide fumes. So I drag him out, got through the garage door that I had kicked in, dragged him to the front. Right as I did, that's when paramedics were arriving, and I actually collapsed also, and we were both transported to the hospital. But I had no issues, and he survived. So it was a good time. He just ended up with a broken door.
You actually do get some bizarre suicide situations out in Vegas. I remember when I was doing a lot of cases with the homicide guys, they would tell me stories about suicides they'd have to work that happened in casinos. And one was a guy jumped from the upper floors in Circus through the atrium and landed down in a buffet in the middle, you know, families eating dinner.
I do remember that.
You remember that?
I actually do remember. I do. Yep.
And I was just like, what? And they're like, they said, dude, you have no idea the things that,
right.
The way people choose to kill themselves sometimes in Vegas is just bizarre. It's an interesting town for many, many reasons. And most of them are really, really good. What's the third incident you were involved in where you had to save a life?
Actually, now that I think that one in Laughlin was my second, or was my third one. My second one was when I was still up here in Vegas. We got dispatched to another suicidal subject. It was at one of the hotels here in Vegas at the parking garage. And we were probably 7 or 8 floors up. This gentleman was obviously under the influence of something, and he was completely naked and sweating profusely. Mm-hmm. But he was on the opposite side of the cement barrier of the 7th floor parking garage. So myself and a couple other officers, same thing. We tried to develop a rapport with him, start talking to him, started moving a little closer. And just at the right second when he was distracted, we grabbed him as slippery as he was, and we pulled him back over the ledge. So that one was pretty simple, just a little nasty.
And one of your incidents was a really severe car accident, right?
Yeah, that was my fourth one. That was down in Laughlin. We had a couple of vehicles involved in an accident. One of them had flipped over during the collision, and it actually sheared off a power pole. So the power pole was crashed down, and we had exposed wiring. Well, during the collision, the gas tank had ruptured, and gas was pouring out everywhere. One of the subjects that was in that vehicle was actually trapped upside down in that vehicle by his seatbelt, and he couldn't move, and he couldn't get out. And now we have all these gas and fumes, and we have these open wires. Fire department hadn't arrived yet, so myself and a couple of my partners, we broke some of the glass and we crawled into the vehicle, and we just had gas pouring all over us. And we're trying to stabilize this guy and cut him out of the seatbelt. And we were able to cut him out of the seatbelt and pull him away from the gas and get him away from the vehicle before anything ignited. And as we were doing so, that's when the fire department arrived and they did their thing to mitigate any kind of explosion. But that was pretty scary for a while because we didn't know if that was going to ignite or explode or anything like that. And that was pretty crazy.
And, you know, that's one of the most fascinating aspects of police work is that you don't know what the next call is going to be. You don't know how you're going to handle it until you get there. And then when you get there, you just react. You do what your training has taught you. You do what your humanity inspires you to do as well. And you just go and put your life in harm's way to save someone you don't know.
And that's it. I mean, it's just, you don't think about it. You just react and do it. And you just kind of sit back later. And once that adrenaline dump goes away and you think about it and you think, wow, I can't believe I just did that.
And speaking of that, you actually did save someone once that you do know, right?
Yeah, one of the paramedics that we worked pretty closely with down in Laughlin. Laughlin's a small town, and we got to know not only many of the citizens, but most of the fire department and EMS personnel down there on a regular basis. So one night, myself, my partner, my sergeant had just arrived down in Laughlin, and we had gotten a call of we didn't know if it was a family disturbance or some sort of other disturbance, but it ended up being a female who was off of her medication and she was having a mental issue. So she had voluntarily decided to go to the hospital to seek some treatment. So we called for an ambulance and two of our local guys arrived. One of them who very familiar with, he was a good guy. We'd always hang out and joke and we got to be pretty good friends. So, this mental patient that we had, she, even though she agreed to go voluntarily, she was still a maybe person. So, you know, she could kind of go either way. We could see her possibly getting a little violent at times because mm-hmm. she was up and down throughout the entire interview that we had with her. So we finally get her on the gurney and they wheel her back to the ambulance. And myself, my sergeant, and my partner are standing to the rear of the ambulance as they're putting her in, and they get her up and they get her inside. And the paramedic, his name's John. John was towards the rear pushing her in. And we're standing there just finishing up the call talking. And we see John collapse on top of her. So the first thought we had was that this woman kicked him. So we jump in the ambulance, you know, thinking that she just kicked him. But that wasn't the fact. He had actually passed out and collapsed on her. So we flip him over. There's a little teeny tiny bench inside the ambulance. So now it's the one paramedic, the female victim, three police officers, and then the paramedic who had passed out, all inside the small ambulance. And we're trying to figure out what's going on. And I checked, and he wasn't breathing, and he had no pulse. So we figured, oh, my God, he had a heart attack. So we immediately started doing CPR. I started doing chest compressions on him, and I yelled to one of my partners. I'm like, you know, grab one of the ambo bags so we can start getting him some oxygen. And we're sitting there doing CPR on him in this little area inside the ambulance. And meanwhile, this female psych patient is still going crazy. So we ended up getting her out of the ambulance so we had more room. We put John onto the ground, and we just continued doing CPR on him. We switched off back and forth until paramedics arrived, the Clark County Fire Department. They got him on their gurney and continued CPR all the way over to Bullhead City, Arizona, where the nearest hospital was. And he survived. He had a heart attack, and luckily we were there when it happened, and he ended up surviving it. And to this day, he's still, every year at the anniversary of it, he'll send me a text message or a message on Facebook. Hey, it's been another year. Congratulations. You know, or he actually blames me for still being alive and tells people it's my fault that he's still around if they're mad at him. But yeah, it was great. I mean, that was the most important thing to me. The most important medal that I've received was to be able to actually save a friend.
Yeah, I love stories like that where, you know, God just puts angels where they need to be when they need to be there, and save someone's life when, if they had been alone and the same situation happened, they probably would not have survived.
Yeah, it was a crazy night.
Have you ever been in a situation where you had to fire your weapon?
I have not. Many times I've come close, but by the grace of God, I have a silver tongue, and I'm able to de-escalate a lot of situations with my mouth and my training, and it's never happened. And I hope in the next several years, as I reach the end of my career, it never does happen.
What do you think makes you a good police officer? What is the one strongest personal virtue that you have that makes you effective as a police officer?
I'd have to say it's just that, you know, I almost care about other people more than I care about myself. And I've done that in personal relationships also. I've always been that person that I just have that need to help people and save people, whether it's from themselves or someone else, you know, whether they're getting themselves into a sticky situation, or there's so many people out there that need help. You know, and I've been blessed where, you know, I grew up in a good family, and I've just always wanted to give back and help people. And I've had people ask me that question, you know, why are you doing this? Or why are you being so nice to me? I remember when I was on motors, I was a sergeant in our traffic bureau, and I had pulled over this young girl. She was going 50 in a 25 zone in a residential neighborhood that I was working. As soon as I stopped her, she just started bawling. I mean, that's a great ticket for a traffic cop. I mean, 25 over and in that, I mean, you know, that's reckless driving if I wanted to push it. I mean, that's a good stat all day long if I just wanted to write her the ticket and be done with it. But, you know, something told me that something just wasn't right. So I just started talking to her, and she's telling me how she's late for work, and she just dropped her kids off with her mom because her husband left her, and she was only 19, 20 years old, and she had already had three kids, and it wasn't a very good part of town, and she just didn't know what to do. She was working a low-paying job, and she couldn't figure out how she was going to support her kids, and I mean, she just lost it, bawling, crying in the car. So, you know, I knelt down, and I sat there, and I talked to her, and we sat there for quite a while, and I just, you know, I calmed her down, and I gave her some information on how she can go about, you know, getting some self-help with our family court system and things like that. And, you know, talked to her about her husband leaving her and her kids and her family. And I was out there for quite a while, and she was still bawling and crying, and she kind of calmed down, and she looked at me, and, you know, here I am. I'm a bigger guy. I'm over 6 foot and, you know, 240 pounds, and with the motor boots and everything, I look like a monster with the helmet on. And she looks up at me and she says, "Why are you doing this? You know, why are you being so nice to me?" And I said, "There's no reason not to be." I said, "I just want to help you make sure you're okay." And you could just see kind of a little bit of life get back into her body. And she just, she was going to be okay for that day. And I knew that, you know, and she, you know, of course I didn't write her a ticket, and obviously she was grateful for that. I mean, there'd be no way she'd ever be able to take care of and get out from under something like that. And I knew that, and I based my stops and things like that on the person and, you know, and what they're going through. It's not just a ticket. It's not just a quota. I mean, that's something that's going to affect someone's life. And if that day I would have been that robotic police officer who handed her a ticket and walked her away, that probably would have pushed her over the edge and just destroyed her. But instead I sat there and I talked to her for a while and I let her go and let her know that there are people out there that care about her and that she's going to get through these hard times. So I think that's just who I am. I just want to help people and make sure that people are okay.
You know, I think that empathy, compassion, and patience are three of the greatest qualities any person can possess. And in police work, that is especially true. You know, one of the things I love about Live PD is we get to see officers who actually have these sorts of encounters. We've seen a police officer go to the store and buy something for someone that they couldn't afford to get for themselves. They were out of gas, and the police officer said, "I will go and get you some gas and pay for it and bring it to you." We see compassion like that, and I think that's a great thing that we're able to show our audience on Live PD, the good things that officers do out there just because they're good people wearing that uniform.
Absolutely.
What is the biggest concern that you have in policing right now? What do you see now as the trend in crime versus 20 years ago?
It seems like things are just more violent now and people don't care. You know, violent crime anywhere is an issue, and here in Las Vegas that's our priority as a law enforcement agency is to reduce violent crime. But it seems like the level of violence has just gone up so much in the 20 plus years that I've been doing this job. Along with that violence is just that lack of remorse. And with that lack of remorse comes the lack of acceptance of responsibility. You know, every time somebody does something wrong, it's never their fault. It's always someone else's fault. Someone else gets blamed. You know, it's not my pants. It's not my shoes. I didn't know that was there. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just, it seems like since I've started, it's just progressed so far the other way where there's just no acceptance of responsibility. And with the level of violence, it's like people don't care. And I don't know if it's from video games because people are desensitized as kids, you know, playing, you know, certain games and things like that, or what we see on TV every day. That people get desensitized to it, that it's just they don't realize that once that bullet leaves that gun, it's never coming back and you don't know who it's going to hit and what it's going to destroy. I mean, people really don't know what a bullet does to the human body and the flesh, you know, but I don't think that people care anymore. I mean, just like I said, the level of violence is just, it's just unprecedented. And to go along with that, just the lack of acceptance for responsibility. So I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've seen over my career.
And your department has a strong emphasis on community policing at this point, right?
Correct. In fact, our motto on our all of our patrol cars is partners with the community. Mm-hmm. We've really gone out of our way to really bring the community involved with every aspect of what we do. You know, in the past, when I first got on, you know, we would have a gang shooting and that was it. We'd roll out there, homicide detectives would roll out there and the person would go off to the hospital or to the coroner's office. They would do their investigation. We'd be done with it. You know, nowadays we go out there and we have community leaders come out. We have pastors from the community come out. We have a lot of community organizations that we work with that will come out. And we talk to the community, we talk to the people around there, and we let them know what's going on. We let them know what's happened, and we let them know, you know, that there's help available for them, you know, if they're grieving, and we have different kinds of trauma programs to get involved in. But it's that aspect of really getting the community involved right from the beginning, that I think has helped us be successful in a lot of instances, especially when it comes to any kind of community unrest for, you know, what we've seen going on around the country with protests against police officers or, you know, court systems, stuff like that. We haven't had that here. And I think that speaks volumes to the commitment and to the cooperation we have as partners with our community, because we're so transparent with our community and we're so involved with our community that they know if something happens that we're going to be there to explain it to them and we're going to be there to guide them through it, both them, their families, and their community partners.
Have you ever arrested any pimps or sex traffickers?
Pimps, yeah, mostly low-level stuff, and this was back in the days. Nowadays, it's just crazy.
And it's internet-based, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And our vice bureau works it tirelessly. These people are trafficking young girls and boys from California and all other states and bringing them here and putting them on the track, as they call it, and it's crazy. I mean, we've stopped prostitutes as young as, you know, 12, 13 years old. And I think the common denominator, I would say, in the majority of these pimps that we're arresting is they're gang members. And so our sheriff has actually combined our gang unit with our vice narcotics bureau, where they're working hand in hand because they go together. You know, a lot of these gang members are pimps and vice versa. And it's just crazy how they're trafficking these kids. And working out at the airport, we have training and we get briefed on it all the time, because they will, you know, take these kids from other states, meet them on the internet, whatever, these runaways, and they'll fly them in. So we try to be there to, you know, see if there's any first indicators that we may see at the airport flying in or flying out with these guys. With the young kids that they have, it's crazy. I mean, they're destroying so many lives. And it's all to put that buck in their pocket. It's crazy.
The first homicide case I worked with, Las Vegas homicide, was the murder of a girl who was found out in the desert off of Pabco Road. And she was unidentified, and they labeled her Pabco Jane Doe. And it was Jimmy Vaccaro and Phil Ramos. Those are detectives on the case. And she had distinctive tattoos on her, and they felt that if we could put this on America's Most Wanted, maybe someone somewhere in the country would recognize these tattoos. And certainly that's exactly what happened the night we aired it. Her mother in Minnesota was watching the show, said, "Oh my God, that tattoo, that's my daughter who I haven't heard from for 2 years." And a pimp had taken her at 14, 15 years old out to Vegas and eventually killed her and just threw her out in the desert. And we were at least able to return the girl's remains to her mother. But it really opened my eyes to just how things go down like that out there.
That's crazy. Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of times people look at it as a victimless crime, and, you know, a lot of people still think, oh, well, prostitution's legal in Las Vegas. Well, it's not.
It's not.
Let me make sure everyone knows that. In Clark County, prostitution is illegal, but people have that, you know, like I said, that attitude of anything goes in Vegas, but Vegas has everything from that the cheap prostitute down at the weekly motels to the ultra-expensive, high-priced prostitutes that fly into town for the big fight weekend, you know, where, you know, they're going to charge you $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a night. But instead of the, you know, the drug-addicted ones that charge you, you know, $20. But it's everywhere. It runs the gamut, the whole spectrum of our society. And it's just, it's definitely not a victimless crime. You know, there's people getting hurt out of it. And that girl or that guy who is being out there and forced to be involved in prostitution, they're a victim, you know, and more so obviously when they're underage. But even the 20 and 30 year old prostitutes that are out there, they're still victims. You know, they didn't choose to be in that life. Whatever happened in their life, something happened, and now they're being victimized repeatedly by these pimps. And it's not a victimless crime.
Now, marijuana is legal in Las Vegas, though, right?
It is. We've had medical marijuana legal for a little bit now. And then last July, they approved recreational marijuana up to 1 ounce.
I've always been amazed at people that ride around in their cars and smoke weed in places where it isn't legal, which is most of America. And, right. You know, they just don't seem to get the memo that Weed smells, and that's a probable cause smell when you're in a vehicle.
When I was on motors, we used to ride around, especially on the strip during nighttime and things like that. And you could ride around and you can smell it. I mean, you smell it coming out of a car. And that was the beauty about being on a Harley, was we could get through traffic and bob and weave and get through up to where we needed to be and find that car, almost, you know, sniff it out like a canine, find out where that smell was coming from, and then pull them over. And even though recreational marijuana is legal, you can't be smoking it in your vehicle. That's still illegal. And you can't be impaired by marijuana while you're driving. That's still illegal. So I think people still don't have all the facts about it. And, you know, and we stop people, you know, but if you have it in your car and you're transporting it from from one of the dispensaries to your house, you're fine. You can't have it in public. You can't be using it in public. So it's just, it's crazy. When I first started this job, one seed of marijuana was felony possession. And now you can have up to an ounce of marijuana for your personal use.
Well, the times, they are changing, Mike.
Yes, they are.
In Nevada, you encounter a lot of people who have firearms in their cars legally, correct?
Correct.
I think a lot of people don't know this, that in Nevada, you don't have to have a concealed carry permit, as I understand it, to have a handgun in your glove box, right?
As long as it's not concealed on your person, you don't need a concealed permit. It's an open carry state. You can walk around with open carry. You could have it in your vehicle. You could have it hidden in your vehicle. You just can't have it concealed on your person. Yeah, state of Nevada, Clark County allows you to open carry and have that firearm in your vehicle concealed. It just can't be on you.
And as a police officer in traffic stops, that's something you're constantly aware of, right?
I know most officers probably think the same way I do. I expect every call that I go. Well, I know that every call that I go on, I know that every stop that I go on, there's at least one gun in play, and that's mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I know everywhere I go, everything I do, there's at least one gun. And we're always taught the plus one rule. So if the guy's got one knife on him, he's got two. If he's got one gun on him, he's got two. So every stop we go on, every call we go on, you always assume that someone's armed. And you know, at the end of the day, it's the hands kill. So watch those hands and control your person. Ultimately, the objective is to go home every night to your family.
Tell me about the A-Ride program.
The A-Ride program is the Advanced Roadside Impaired Driving Enforcement. What it is it's a class that's basically one notch below our drug recognition expert program. For the drug recognition expert program, you go through several weeks of training and you have to do all kinds of tests and stuff like that with measuring people's blood pressure and temperature, and it's for court purposes to determine whether or not someone's under the influence of a certain classification of a controlled substance. The A-Ride program is an advanced program just above our kind of DUI detection. And the majority of our traffic officers have this program. So what it is it familiarizes the officer with the different classifications of controlled substance that are out there and how they affect your body. Whether or not, let's say cannabis causes horizontal gaze nystagmus in your eye, or whether or not being under the influence of an opiate is going to make your pupils dilated or constricted, whether your heart rate is going to go up because you used marijuana or because you used cocaine. So it's a familiarization program or class where it's going to help that officer who does a traffic stop more readily identify someone who's under the influence of a controlled substance as opposed to being under the influence of alcohol. You walk up to a car, it's pretty easy to tell if someone has been drinking. You're gonna smell it. But if someone has been using cocaine or heroin or methamphetamine, obviously you're not gonna smell it. So you have to look for these other signs and symptoms as far as their eyes, their speech, the way they walk. In fact, their carotid artery, whether or not how fast it's beating. So all these things are gonna give an officer reasonable suspicion to conduct field sobriety tests on this person and determine whether or not they're fit to drive that vehicle.
What advice would you give people that are considering becoming police officers?
make sure it's what you want to do. It's a very tough career, and it's only getting tougher. It's got to be something that you feel passionate about. You know, it can't be something where, you know, you got laid off from your previous job and you're browsing through the want ads and you said, oh, well, hey, the police department's hiring and they have a good starting salary with benefits, so I think I'm going to do it. It shouldn't be a job. This should be something that you want to do, and it should be done for the right reasons, because you want to help people, because you want to protect your family, because you want to protect your community. At the end of the day, we live here. I want my kids growing up in a safe environment, and I want my neighbors being able to go out and do what they want to do and be safe. It's about having that community pride and wanting to protect your neighborhood, protect your community. So it's got to be done for the right reasons, not just for a paycheck or not just for medical benefits, but it's got to be something that you truly feel in your heart, and it's something that you're going to stick with and make it a career, not just a job.
You know, I spent so much time out there working cases over those years with AMW, and the one thing I learned was that there really are two Las Vegases. There's the Strip in downtown, the tourist Las Vegas, and then there's the real Las Vegas, where you have people that are third, fourth generation. Neighborhoods with old, there's one neighborhood with older houses. I think Andre Agassi lived in that neighborhood. And it's a part of Vegas you don't get to see. And then I was taken by Detective Jimmy Vaccaro one time to the Skid Row section of Vegas, which most people will never ever see that. And there's two cities at least, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I was just talking about that this morning. I think the majority of officers probably live as far out away from the Strip as you possibly can, because everyone thinks you live in a hotel when you tell them, oh, you live in Vegas. Oh, how's it good? You know, they think you go to the Strip every day. And I can honestly tell you that I couldn't tell you the last time I drove down the Strip, you know, like on my day off. Or it's only when people come into town that have never been out there. So. Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, you go to one area of town and you have multi-million dollar homes on golf courses, and then you can go to another part of town and it's dilapidated housing with a high percentage of street gangs. So we really have everything here. I mean, it's just like I would imagine any other city in America, where you have the good, the bad, and the ugly. Of course, the Strip in downtown receive most of the attention. That's where all the bright lights and glitter is. But that's not the true essence of Vegas that most officers see on a daily basis.
Did you work on the huge shootout that happened about 10 years ago between the Mongols and the Hells Angels down in Laughlin?
I was down there. Absolutely. Yep. That was a mess.
The wildest video shootout caught on tape I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was crazy. In fact, that night that had happened, I was working day shift down there, and we had gotten off probably about 6 or 7 in the evening, and me and a couple buddies went out and had some dinner and kind of walked around and saw the sights, and man, we decided we'd head back to bed. I was asleep for a couple hours, and I get a phone call from one of my buddies, and he was in Vegas, and he goes, Mike, what the heck is going down there? And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, turn on your radio. So as soon as I turn on my radio, I hear, you know, shots fired, roll me other units, start calling people back in. We didn't know what the heck was going on, but you know, through the radio traffic, we can tell it was something big. My partner and I, we didn't even get called out. We just threw on our uniforms and jumped outside and jumped in our cars, and we headed up to Harrah's. When we arrived, there were still shots being fired down by the Riverwalk. It was just absolute chaos.
So many people armed. I mean, just there were hundreds of armed people, bikers from two opposite rival gangs.
Right. I mean, they had planned everything. You know, they knew what they were going to do. They rolled in with their bikes ready. And as we came in, like I said, we were still hearing shots being fired outside. We were literally stepping over biker bodies in the parking lot as we were going in to find out what was going on. And then once everything kind of settled down and we started getting everyone into custody and we had them separated, we had one room full of Mongols and we had one room full of Hells Angels. But we, at that point, we had the entire area parking lot was a crime scene. So we had to go car to car to car checking these vehicles to see if anyone was possibly hurt or inside of these cars or under these cars and check for any kind of evidence. And yeah, that was a long day.
And a lot of people rushed to hospitals too, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yep. You know, people were taken off everywhere. Luckily, down in Laughlin, being that it's a tri-state area, we have interagency agreements between ourselves and some of the Arizona agencies and California agencies, because it's right there in the tri-state area. So we had a lot of support from California agencies and Arizona agencies that came over to assist us during this time to help augment the investigation and get everything under control. We had called for obviously more units from our agency, but you know, they're 90 minutes away coming from Las Vegas, even, you know, rolling code getting down there. But yeah, it was a crazy, crazy night, and very thankful we had the assistance of our surrounding agencies to help us.
Now, I'm a huge boxing fan all of my life, and I've always wanted to be in Vegas on a major fight night. And so far, that has not been scratched off my bucket list. So can you help me understand what it's like to be on the Strip, especially as a police officer, on the night of a major, major fight?
You know, it's crazy. I mean, obviously, we have a high, huge influx of people coming in from everywhere. The majority of people are driving in from California. And we get that every weekend. But when we have those large fights, the Pacquiao fight and Mayweather fights and things like that, and even now, now that we have our own professional hockey team that's out there kicking butt, and the Raiders are coming, so, you know, we plan for it. We have a special event section for our department, and they work with these different venues to determine, you know, what their estimated crowd size is going to be and how many officers, you know, it would take to properly protect the area. And those companies actually hire the off-duty officers working in conjunction with the department to facilitate security for those areas. So we have a lot of officers working overtime assignments. But in addition, we have our on-duty officers that will augment them. And usually our watch commander who's on duty that night will see how many people are out and about and what the crowd size is. And based on that, he will send units, patrol units from different area commands to come down and just show police presence, to show that we're down there, we're working it, we're watching it, we're being vigilant, and people are safe. So we have a lot of plans in place to be out there and keep people safe so they can have that good time on the Strip and come to Vegas and party and have a great time and enjoy the fights and all the other good things that we got going here, especially downtown and on the Strip. But our special events section does a great job of making sure that these different venues are covered properly.
Do you have any celebrity cop encounter stories to tell? You ever pulled over Wayne Newton?
Never pulled over Wayne Newton. I had sushi one day and he was there eating at the sushi restaurant and I actually took a picture with him. But no, I offhand, I can't think of, I mean, I've stopped some local people here.
Floyd Mayweather?
No, never stopped Floyd. Never stopped Floyd. I've stopped people from his entourage many times. but never stopped Floyd. Not a whole lot of celebrity encounters.
Now, during my years with America's Most Wanted, I did more cases with Vegas homicide than any other city in the country. I got really, really tight with those guys, and we closed and solved a lot of cases with the help of our viewing public for them. Detective Jimmy Vaccaro, Phil Ramos, Paul Bingham, Michael Franks. Michael Franks, who worked the Tupac homicide, actually, with his partner. And did you ever meet any of these guys or know any of them?
I know who they are. Jimmy and Phil and Paul, I mean, they're legends on the department. When I came on, they were already in homicide. They were already in the detective bureau. And as a young rookie police officer, when you were on the scene and homicide showed up, you didn't talk to them. You know, they were the salty old detectives that were standing off in the corner that you would just look at and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they've been on so long. I've been on 5 minutes. And so they had that respect of all the younger officers and all the patrol officers on the street. But you were almost intimidated or scared to go talk to them. You didn't know if they were going to bite your head off or what. You know, I remember one homicide sergeant who, when he would show up to our scenes, he would be wearing a trench coat and kind of a wide brim hat, and had a cigar. So, you know, it was like something that I would see off of TV when I was a kid, and it was pretty intimidating. So I know who they are, and they're legendary around Metro, but I don't know them personally as far as having any kind of interaction with them in that way.
One of the biggest cases I worked on out there was the shootout at Mr. D Sports Bar with Officer Dennis Devitt and an armed robber. And to frame this story, there was a band called Pigs in a Blanket. It was Metro Mike Richards and some other Vegas cops, and they had a band, and they would play at Mr. D Sports Bar like one night a month. And so all the other cops, their friends, would come, and on this particular night, the bar is packed full of police officers off duty. The band's playing Pigs in a Blanket, and of all the officers in the bar, Dennis Devitt was the only one who had a pistol on his person, because most of them, they went to drink and relax, so they weren't armed. Dennis wasn't going to drink, so he was armed, and he got into a toe-to-toe shootout with this gangbanger where they stood face-to-face. These guys came in and started shooting up the bar and hitting people. People were going down. Dennis sprung into action, stood toe-to-toe with this robber, and they traded bullets into each other's bodies. And Dennis survived the shootout. The other guy staggered outside and died, and we profiled the one who got away on America's Most Wanted. Did you ever meet Dennis?
Yeah, I know who Dennis is. Dennis ended up, I think he actually finished off his career in motors.
He did.
So he was a traffic officer for a while. And yeah, I've never heard anything but good stuff about Dennis. And yeah, I remember the Mr. D shootout and how crazy that was. And, you know, like you were saying before, sometimes there's just that angel there in the right place. And I think some people picked the wrong place to do a robbery.
A bar full of cops.
You go into a bar and coincidentally, it's full of cops. So,
yeah, Dennis was severely injured, but he went back to work about a year later, and he worked till he retired. And he was named Top Cop of the Year the following year. I went to the Top Cop Awards with him in Washington, D.C.
In Washington, yep, I sure remember that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he saved a lot of lives that night. There were five or six people that were wounded in that shootout.
Oh yeah, if Dennis hadn't been there, who knows how many more people would have been killed.
Mm-hmm. Looking back, wrapping up this interview, what's your perspective on this life you've led in uniform?
I hope that people can look back and say that I was a good cop, and I had an honorable career. You know, like I said, this is something that I think is a calling for a lot of people, and I know it was for me. I just hope someday that, you know, my son, who can really appreciate that what dad did for all these years, and why I did what I did. You know, growing up, a lot of times we don't really see eye to eye with our parents, and I was that way a lot with my dad. But you know, being that he was a police officer and now I'm in the shoes that he wore, I see the difficult things that he went through, and I appreciate that more, and I miss him more now. He passed away from cancer a few years back. You know, one of the most important things that happened at the beginning of my career was, you know, my dad got to pin my badge on me during my graduation ceremony. You know, we're old school Italian family, and there wasn't a lot of hugs and kisses and I love yous. But that day that I graduated, afterwards, my dad came up to me and he never wanted me to be a cop. He never wanted me to go down that road, because he saw the things, you know, that I'm seeing now, and how really bad that the world can be. He came up to me afterwards, after he had pinned that badge on me, and he told me he was proud of me. And that was the first time in my life that my father had told me he was proud of me. And that just, I think that inspired me more than he would ever know. So I hope that one day people look back and they can say that, you know, I did a good job that I was here for the right reason.
When are you going to retire?
I have four more years, and then I'm done.
And then what are you going to do? I got a feeling you're going to do something else.
You know, I don't know. Just kind of play it by ear. I'll probably take a little time off and grow a beard, since I've been shaving for the last 22 years every day.
Move to Pahrump?
I've never been able to have a beard.
What? You're going to move to, you're going to retire in Pahrump?
I probably won't be going to Pahrump. That's not on the agenda.
Well, Mike, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on the show. Be safe out there. Continue to do the great work you've been doing for the people of Las Vegas. And God bless you, man.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. You take care as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.